have Excels today. But first, of course, we have to spend, how many lectures have we had so far?
Three.
There's been three lectures, well really two lectures, to build a proper foundation. So that when I tell you that we're going to do simple arithmetic computations on points, in particular when I tell you we're going to answer simple linear predicate kind of questions, line side, triangle orientation, plane side, in circle test, but these all have a real algorithm learning. It's just linear algebra. Okay? And it's just computing determinants. So today, we get to one of the real classics of computational geometry. If there's a canon of computational geometry, this is one of the first entries. And the problem starts like this. We're going to do it in 2D. So the input will be n points in, and we're going to add this other thing here. We're going to say in general position. Has anyone seen this expression before, in general position? In general position means that when I do those line side tests, the counterclockwise test, it never comes out to zero. Another way to say that, when does it come out to zero? It comes out to zero when they're collinear. So this will mean no 3 points collinear. Now in real life, this might be too strong an assumption to make. In which case, you're going to have to probably make whatever code you write a little bit more complex to check if things are collinear and to maybe adapt and do something different. These are what we will call, if there are 3 points that are collinear, is what we would call a degeneracy. So these point sets will also use the word non-degenerate. So we're going to take n points in general position, and the output is what we're going to call the convex hull. Of the set P. So we'll call the input set P, and we'll get output the convex hull, and then I'll give you a picture, and then I'll give you a definition. Given the points, and you'll find very quickly that once you start drawing points, it's actually pretty hard to draw them in general position, because as soon as you draw like 5, somehow there's 3 that are collinear. Pretend these are not collinear. Here are the points. The convex hull is this polygon, this convex polygon that contains them. Let me just go back to some definitions and we'll flesh this out. So remember we defined convex combinations, and I did it in probably a little bit of a scary way. I said that the convex combinations are the ones that are, they're non-negative, linear, and affine, which is true, but maybe it doesn't give you the right idea. Let me just start by saying what it means for a set to be convex. So given a set U in, let's say, Euclidean space for now, RD, the convex closure of U convex closure. Define it. This is the notation, it's two big C's. It's the set of all convex combinations. And so convex combinations had to be linear. So there were linear combinations of the points. Let's write it as UI. So U is a set U1, UN. So it's a linear combination such that it has to be non-negative. Each of the alpha i's is greater than 0, and it has to be affine, so the sum of alpha i's is 1. Here we go, linear, non-negative, and affine. Simplest case, I'll say the second simplest case is just 2 points. Maybe the simplest case is just 1 point. Maybe we should do the simplest case. What's the convex closure of just 1 point?
Itself.
Good. If I have 2 points, the convex closure, let's call these A and B. It's the line segment between them. So if I draw this straight line segment just like this, I guess. This is every point on this line segment can be written as a convex combination. Now all these big sums just become two parts, right? There's going to be an alpha A and an alpha for B. And they sum to 1, so it has to be affine. So the way we write this most often is that if I take the point X in here, X is equal to 1 minus T times A plus T times B. Where the coefficients now, the coefficients in this linear combination are T and 1 minus T. You can check, it's affine. What does it mean to B to be affine? Coefficients sum to 1. They sum to 1. Non-negative. Well, it's only non-negative assuming we take T in the interval 0 to 1. If T is in 0 to 1, then 1 minus T is also in 0 to 1. It's non-negative. If I take T equals 0, I get A. If I get T equals 1, I get B. If I get T equals, what, 1 half? For example, I get half of A plus half of B. I get the midpoint. It's 1 half A plus 1 half B. This looks a little funny. It looks like this, I'm summing points. Remember we said that wasn't generally going to be allowed, that we should only be summing vectors, but I said when we take convex combinations, it's allowed. Convex combinations and affine combinations. Any kind of, really any affine combination is allowed. Gives us an affine combination of points is another point. And the reason that works is that this extra condition that has to sum to 1 can be represented by taking the points and giving them another coordinate, bringing them up to homogeneous coordinates, and writing them as vectors in one dimension higher, which is what we did to do the line side tests. That's homogeneous coordinates. Right. So, that's a convex combination of 2 points. I haven't actually given you a definition of what it means for a set to be convex, so let's say that a set U in RD is convex if and only if it's equal to its convex closure. Okay, this is probably not if you've seen a definition of convexity, you may have seen different ones. This is one I like. It says that if you take the convex combination of some of the points, you end up with just one of the other points. And you can check that that's true on the line here. Like if I actually took the whole line segment, any point on that line segment can be written as a convex combination of the points. That's trivial, in fact, because it could be just taken, it is itself a point in the set. The converse is the trickier part. If I have a set that's equal to its convex closure, then that's saying that what I that after I took a convex combination of points, I landed in the set again. And you can check that that's true for something like a line segment. The other definition that you often see is that U has to contain the line segment let's say A, B, between any pair A, B in the set. Okay, and this is maybe the more useful definition for just when you look at a picture. So some examples. We already saw a single point is convex, because it is equal to its convex closure. Let's take, say, a triangle like this. The whole set, the whole thing. Yes, it's convex. Let's say we take, you know, a circle. It's convex. Here's where this definition gets useful. If I take a set like this, some kind of kidney bean-like shape, it's not convex. And, well, the intuition often people say, they look at this, they say, well, it's not convex because it has a dent. And it's true. Convex things don't have any indentions. But the way you witness or prove that this is not convex is you just give two points, A and B. You draw their straight line segment. And you, if you see that that line segment passes outside the set, it's not convex. So this definition is a quick way to give witnesses to non-convexity. Get a couple, so this one, like, no. Here's another example. Here's a set. Here's a set that doesn't have any, it doesn't have any indentions. Indentations, is that a word? Indentions, not a word, is it? Indentured servants. Are you grad students? Indentured servants. No. So this is a set. It's not convex. It's two convex sets. The union is not convex, because I just take a point A over here, and I take a point B in here, and the line segment passes outside the set. So this idea that you're going to just locally see a dent somewhere if it's not convex is not really true. Because this is a set, but it's not a convex set. If you happen to be perusing these other computational geometry books out there, and I don't want to say they're all worthless, but they're not great, you may see the following terrible abuse. And they will tell you that the convex closure is called the convex hull. This is terrible, and it's not true. Let me tell you what the convex hull is. The convex hull is the boundary of the convex closure. Now, I mistakenly only brought one color, so I'm not going to be able to draw a really good example here. But like, if we took the convex closure of this set, you know, you would end up with some shape that looked like this. Because you take every pair of points here and you draw their line segments, everything, you fill the whole thing in. And then the convex hull would be the boundary. It would look like just this part. Empty on the way. So I'm going to write it as CH instead of CC. Convex hull. Is the boundary of the convex closure. Okay. And it's denoted CH of U. Alright. In the case of points in the plane, which is the case we're going to do today, there's a simple description of the convex hull. Because the convex hull is now going to be just a polygon. And to describe a polygon in terms of points, you can just list the points. If the points say, this was P1 maybe, and this was P2, and this was P3, and P4, etc., you could output simply P2, P4, and then the names of all the other points in order as they go around the polygon. And that gives a description of the convex hull. Implicit in that, maybe, is a description of the whole convex closure, but the point is that we're only really describing the outside of the set. And there's a couple reasons we do this. One is that if you have a mass of points, and you want to give a shape which describes roughly the shape of the point set, this is a great first approximation. You can also test for kinds of outliers. If you have a bunch of, if you have a polygon like this and a new point comes along that's outside of this convex hull, then you can tell that maybe that point is an outlier, whereas if most of the points say were on the inside, or near, at least near the convex hull. Let's list that as two very general reasons for doing this. It's all really kind of summary of the point set. And it can do this a lot. Okay. So let's discover an algorithm. I'm going to give you, let's draw some points. And if you know an algorithm already, maybe don't shout it out until I get desperate, because I'm perfectly happy with a really naive algorithm. I'm more happy with a naive algorithm. So don't get clever. Tell me how to start. First, let's just find one vertex of the convex hull. Yeah.
I choose like the one that has like the leftmost baseline coordinates.
Yeah. So let's try that. Let's say we look here and we say this point is the leftmost. It's really got to be in the convex hull. We'll give an argument for why it really that's correct. But for now, I believe it. Now the output was going to be a polygon going counterclockwise around the point set. What should be the next point? How do we find the next point? Okay, Nick?
You can go like start down and scan.
Yeah, you can kind of like look out in every direction here and find, as you look around, until you get the first point. How do you actually do that?
You draw like a line from that point to like at a particular angle, or array.
So you just try each angle.
Like an array. I don't know.
Any other ideas? You sort them from left to right.
No, sort the angle.
Sort by angle. So you can actually sort the whole thing and then just find the minimum. Okay. So let's write our algorithm. Start with leftmost. Sort by angle. Take them in. I guess we'll call that them in. And now what? Now I need to find another edge. So I could. What do I do now?
Shouldn't you be looking for the max angle, not the minimum, to make sure that you get the boundaries?
Well, it depends on whether we measure this angle or this angle. We want max or min.
Okay, okay.
It's true. In one way it's the min, another way it's the max. We take it from this angle. So now we need another point. Just repeat. Okay. Good. All right. Go to. All right, I think this will work. Let's just see. So I look from here and I look at all these angles. And this one. And then I go again and look at all these angles. Maybe it really should be I guess max is a nicer way to think about this angle. Once we have two edges, we would look at these angles. So it makes sense to talk about this side. And we look for the max, okay. And we sweep through until we find the maximum. Again, until we get all the way back to the beginning. There's also a physical algorithm for this, which one you've probably seen, which is maybe good for intuition. Imagine that instead of having, you know, points and coordinates, someone just gave you a big piece of wood and they put a bunch of nails in it and just wrap a string around it. And you wrap the string taut, that'll give you that polygon you get where the string actually touches those nails is going to be the convex hull. It's because the taut string really gives you a straight line. That intuition is actually used in some convex hull algorithms. I think we probably won't get to it today. This is a pretty nice algorithm. It looks like one you should probably know from an undergrad algorithm class or even an intro to computer science class. Anyone know what this algorithm is called?
Graham.
Almost. If I didn't say sort here, if you just said find the maximum. Because obviously, like, finding the max in a set is easier than sorting the set. Do you believe that? It's true. So if you just needed to find the maximum, let's just say find the maximum. Because you can find the max in linear time, whereas sorting takes like n log n time, so you don't want to keep sorting all these things. This is the name for this kind of algorithm. This is selection sort. Is this selection sort? Certainly looks like it. I wanted it to be min because, you know, usually you do selection sort from the beginning, you know, sorting from the middle. But if you want to sort from the end, what do? You go through the list, you find the largest element, put it at the end. Go through what's left, find the largest element, put it in the second to last spot. Okay, you've probably heard it in the reverse, right? You go through the list, you find the minimum element, put it in front. Go through, find the next smallest element, put it in front. In the case of this, where we were sort of implicitly outputting the points as we go, we said, okay, I'm just going to tell you what the next point is, what the next point is, what the next point is. And it's just a selection stuff. What's the running time of this algorithm? Shout it out. I know you all know it.
N squared.
Yeah. Right, because, you know, finding the max takes, if there's I points left, it takes over I time. And so the total running time is the sum from I equals 1 to N of over pi, N squared. Stereotypical quadratic algorithm. It looks like sorting. In fact, we're going to do sorting. We'll bring this sorting by angle back in a second, although we're not actually going to compute any angles. Does anyone know why we don't need to ever compute angles to do this stuff? Even to sort by angle. Do you need to sort by angles without computing an angle? Think about it for a second. We only know a couple things in this class. Yeah?
It just matters like the slope between the lines?
You could use the slope, maybe, except that we kind of wrapped around.
Angle?
What's that? The volume of a triangle, right, which is a determinant. Just half of the determinant of the vector. It's a line side test. So again, it's just this kind of determinant test that we do. We're going to give us a way to sort by angle in a way that doesn't require us to do angle computations. Because if you're actually going to compute the angle here, I don't even know how do you compute angles. You're going to do trigonometry, like trig lookup tables. No, we know how to compare and order things by angle. Because if one of these vertices made a bigger angle than the other one, then that would tell us something about the orientation of this triangle. And we know how to compute the orientation of triangles. In fact, it's the only thing we know how to do so far. I assume you probably know some other things, but it's at least what we spent the last 2 classes on. All right. So this looks like selection sort. It really is a kind of selection sort. There's a couple things we can do with this observation. So one is we can try to improve this algorithm, because our goal is to be n log n, just like in sorting. And we can try to improve it by, say, bringing in the good ideas we have about sorting. Like, how do you get sorting done n log n? You know, divide and conquer. That works. I'll just tell you, that works. We're not going to do that today. We're going to do something else. See, we can. This is what you might call using one of the tricks from sorting, the sorting tricks. The other possibility is we're going to actually just use sorting. And this is the one we're going to look at. There's a million convex hull algorithms because there are a million sorting algorithms. And just about any sorting algorithm you use can kind of be turned one way or another into a convex hull algorithm. And I'll show you at least my favorite way of doing it. But before we do that, we should talk just a second about why this naive algorithm that we described is actually correct. There's a couple subtle things that went on here. You see, we said that just listing the vertices of a polygon in counterclockwise order was a good enough representation of a convex polygon. In fact, you could represent non-convex polygons that way. But if it's a convex polygon, there's a couple things we know. And one of the most important is that not only is it described by the points here, it's also uniquely described by the edges in the sense that each edge, if I extended it into a line, this is what we would call a supporting line. Right. This supporting line has the entire convex closure, or if you will, just all the input points on one side or on it. So this supporting line actually witnesses to the fact that this edge is in fact on the convex hull. Why is that true?
Otherwise, this line would go through the set.
Otherwise, this line would go through the set.
All the other points are on the other side of the line.
All the other points are on this side of the line. Finish the argument. Let's take this one first. How do you finish that argument? Just the fact that all these points are on this side of the line, what does that tell you?
So if there is even a single point on the other side of the line, mm-hmm. then that point and any other point, if I connect, then that line would intersect this one.
Is that true? Let's see. What if the other point were over here? Then, I don't think that any of those intersect this line segment. Hang on, ideas? Well, here's something we know. We know that this line segment is in the convex closure. The convex closure contains all line segments formed by pairs of points and combinations of points. So we know it's at least in the convex closure. Is it on the boundary? Well, if it wasn't on the boundary, then there'd be some point somewhere over here, which was in the convex hull, or in the convex closure of the seven points. Actually, to show that this doesn't happen, we can use yet a third definition of convex closure, which is the one that sometimes appears in topology textbooks, is that the convex closure is also the intersection of every convex set that contains the points. Computationally, this seems really scary, right? It's on this intersection of uncountably infinite set. But it's true, and maybe for homework I'll have you work out the equivalence of these three definitions. In our case, all we need to observe is that a half space, or half plane, is convex. Here is that this supporting line bounds a half plane, so that's a convex set. And we know the convex closure is convex by definition. And we know that the convex closure is contained, it must be in completely contained in this half plane. Right, so this is on the boundary, and in fact, every edge of the convex hull has this property of being supporting, having a the line through the 7 points form a supporting line, and so. Describing a convex polygon, you can describe it as the set of convex closures, the convex closure of the set of points, or the set of all convex combinations of that set of points, or you can take what's called a dual view to think of it as the intersection of a collection of half spaces. I'll switch to the high dimensional vocabulary. So I'll say half space, even though 2D is just a half plane. I may say, at some point, say supporting hyperplane. You should know that I just mean, in 2D, a hyperplane is just a line. All right, so why is our algorithm okay? Each edge that we output, necessarily, we actually, by sorting, we checked that we had a supporting line here. So we guarantee that each of these edges really was an edge of the convex hull, and we outputted each one of them. That's pretty handy, but that's roughly the idea. We can also check one other thing with regards to this connection to sorting. And that is that although we're going to get this down to n log n, there really is the same kind of n log n lower bound that we see in sorting. And so the way we prove lower bounds, the simplest way to prove lower bounds, although most lower bounds are not simple, sorting lower bounds tend to be not so bad, because all you have to do is show that if you can solve this problem, then you can sort the points, say, in linear time. Right, so let me give you a sorting algorithm that uses convex hull as a black box. Planar convex hull. Does that make sense? All right. And this will also hit, again, this theme we're going to see throughout the course, which is that all these one-dimensional problems that you saw, sorting, selection, they're all just one-dimensional geometry problems. So let me just draw you an input to sorting as a set of real numbers. Let's call them alpha 1. Oh, I want to sort them. So let's just say the input here is alpha 1 to alpha n, not in sorted order. There are real numbers. And we're going to take this map, which takes the points and maps them up onto the parabola. So we saw this before. We saw this when we lifted 2D things into 3D. Here we're just going to lift 1D into 2D. And we lift them up onto a parabola. So this point might have been alpha 1, and it gets lifted up to be a point in 2D. That's alpha 1 squared. Then say here was alpha 2, becomes alpha 2 squared. Similarly, all the other points. And so I took a set of n points on the line, n real numbers. I map them up into n points on the plane. And look, now three of them are on a line. That actually follows from the convexity of the problem. So it satisfies our input conditions. And so now we can run our convex hull algorithm. Let's do that. We take our convex hull algorithm and we get a polygon. And it tells us that there's this polygon, and if I just walk from vertex to vertex along this polygon until I get to the leftmost, I know that's going to be the first one in sorted order. And now I just, as I go around in counterclockwise order, I'm hitting the points in sorted order. So as the list of vertices that describe the polygon, in fact, are listing them in sorted order, and so it gives me the sorting of this. Now, it only took me linear time to extract that order from this polygon. So if I compute that convex hull faster than n log n time, then I would be sorting in less than n log n time. Here's a question.
Yeah, Hold on, actually I thought if there are repeats, then this viewpoint breaks.
If there are
two instances of the same point.
Yeah.
So then you cannot actually draw line segments because there are two points, one on top of another. But
if you have two points on top of each other, then you have 3 points going here. So it's not that would be a degenerate example. And and the reason it's a problem is not so much because you can't find supporting hyperplanes, it's because now you don't actually have a unique description of the convex hull. You can decide a minimal one, but even then it's not unique. Okay, so look, if I can do convex hull fast, I can sort fast. We've got to make sure that we're keeping this in the same model. And this is one of the reasons why it's useful to understand that we're going to do convex hull in a comparison model. So these lower bounds still apply. Or this n log n lower bound that we usually see for sorting does not apply if we can do really advanced arithmetic on the points. You can do bucketing and things like that. You can do better than n log n. So let me just write this here, and this is our omega n log n lower bound. I'll call this a sorting lower bound. I mean, lower bounds from sorting are pretty much our only source of non-trivial lower bounds that are easy to detect in classrooms. Everything else is pretty much everything else is hard. Okay. So we need a better algorithm. I promised you that what we're going to do is not bring in the sorting tricks abstractly, but to just apply a sorting algorithm and see how to make it work. And so the algorithm we're going to use is called GramScan. GramScan is named after a guy named Ron Graham. Have you heard of Ron Graham?
Juggler.
Yeah, he's a juggler. He's a good juggler. He was president of the International Juggling Association, I think. He's also a famous mathematician. Supposedly he could juggle three Rubik's cubes and solve them at the same time. I was trying to learn how to do that for a while, but it's very hard to turn a Rubik's cube with one hand. They actually sell something called, Cube Lube. So like, and I couldn't get myself to buy it. Ron Graham, good juggler, good mathematician, invented this algorithm way back in 1972 in the prehistory of computational geometry in the early days. I don't know, was there Unix in 1972? I wasn't alive in 1972. Here we go. Here's GramScan. We want to get n log n time, and I promise that all the hard work is going to be done by the sorting algorithm. Well, some of the hard work will be done when we analyze it, but not that hard. So let's start with our original idea, what somebody said before, let's sort the points by angle. Like I said, we're going to use our linear predicates. Just simple determinant computations so that we don't compute any angles. We're going to process the points one at a time. After we have them in order, we're going to process them. I'll say what that means. But we're going to go through them one at a time, and what we'll do is we'll keep the convex hull of the first I points we've seen so far. So after I steps, we've seen I points, and we'll have the convex hull of those points. And we see another point, I plus 1 points, we'll have the convex hull of the first I plus 1 points. This is what we would call an algorithmic invariant. So it's going to allow us to do induction on the algorithm to prove it's correct. Let me draw the picture of the algorithm, and we'll see what we mean by processing the points. We're going to stick with the same idea that we started with the leftmost point, and we sort them. So let's say here's one, two. I have to do this carefully, otherwise it's not an interesting example. So three, four, six, and seven. Okay, so they're sorted. And now I'm going to get, let's call this point zero. So the leftmost point was zero. And now we're going to push P0 and P1 onto a stack. All right, and this stack is going to be where we store a tuple. And so now I have this line segment really is the convex hull of the first 2 points in sort order. When I get to when I look at the next point, well, I'm going to do this in a loop here. So for I equals 2 to n minus 1. N minus 1 because I started at 0. What I'll do is I'll nest another loop in here, and while this is going to be my symbol for an orientation test. It's checking, I'm going to have 3 points here, and this will tell me what, plus 1 if they're counterclockwise and minus 1 if they're clockwise. So I'm going to look at the stack, I'm going to look at the one element in the stack, the zero element of the stack. I'm assuming I'm representing the stack as some kind of array here. And I'm going to look at the point PI. And while this orientation is equal to negative 1, then I'm going to pop the stack. And when I'm done with that, I'm going to push PI onto the stack. Let's walk through it. I start with finding the leftmost point. I sort them. I guess I should have put that in here. This is where the sort by angle happens. In fact, it's all the work. It's all the n-log-n work. I look at the next point, it's a 2. And I look at what? The orientation of stack of this point. Wait, is it what? This one, and this one. So 0, 1, 2. This is oriented the right way. It's making a left turn as I go from 0 to 1 to 2. And that's a good thing. I should be taking only left turns as I go around. So this loop never does anything. And I just push P2, point 2 onto the stack. Let's draw the stack over here. So I started with 0, 1, this is my output stack, and now I have a 2 on it. The next point I see is 3, and so I looked what? While the orientation of stack, I guess I'm doing this backwards, so stack element 0 is going to be the top of the stack. This is 1. So I need a stack where I can just peek into the top two elements. And what do? I look at 2, or 1, 2, 3. Again, this is oriented in counterclockwise order. This is okay. I don't have to do anything here. And so, in fact, this quadrilateral is the convex hull of those first 4 points. Everything is good. I didn't have to even look at this loop yet. Let's take the next one, 4. Oh, I should have pushed this on this now. So when I look at point 4, what do? I see 2, 3, 4. So I look at 2, 3, and then the next point. And that's oriented clockwise. Did I write this wrong? Yeah, that's right. Negative 1 is clockwise. So what does that mean? It means I should pop the stack. So I'm going to get rid of this 3. And I repeat, I'm going to keep doing this. So I look now, and now the top of the stack looks like 1, 2, 4. And 1, 2, 4 is a good left turn. It breaks me out of this loop, and I can push 4 onto the stack. Maybe I'll pop it more thoroughly. All right. Next point is a 5. 2, 4, 5 is a left turn. That's okay. 6, 2, 4, 6, or 4, 5, 6. 4, 5, 6 is a right turn, so I have to pop the stack. Now I look at the stack, I have 2, 4, 6. 2, 4, 6 is still a right turn, I pop the stack again. One, two, six is a left turn. It breaks me out of the loop and I push the 6 onto the stack. All right, the last one is a 7. From here, 2, 6, 7, it's a left turn. And I'm done. Questions about that? How I was running that algorithm? Is it good that you have to like walk through it? Oh yeah.
The maximum number of pop that you do, you do one each time, like.
Well, you loop through here. You could loop through this many times.
No, yes, but I'm talking about when it. Yes, it will be one. No, like if I have 3 points,
yeah.
The third point, I pop that. It could happen like a pop, and I have to pop another.
Yeah, that's what we saw here, right? When I had this pop 5, and then I pop 4 also.
No, yes, but it doesn't happen that I have to pop 3. No, never.
Yeah, it could have been that I'd already popped 3.
Yeah.
But it could be, that's going to come up when we do the analysis right now. Because if you just look at this, you see I two nested loops. The outer loop loops n times. The inner loop has this while loop. In theory, this can run also n times. A very naive analysis says, is this n squared again? It's not n squared. It's better than n squared. Anyone want to guess how fast this runs? Kind of guess. No, better than that. Better than n log n. It's a linear time algorithm. And I think this is maybe what you were hinting at.
Is it not trivial? You always you can have top 2 elements in the stack.
You say the first part again. You only
3m.
Try. What's the word you say?
Is it a 3m?
3n. Oh, what's the constant? Oh man, that's bold. I don't know. We can figure out the constant maybe. Something
but
like
when
that.
You sorted by angle, didn't you have to do n log n?
Oh, yeah. So you did n log n here, but I did the like I said, all the n log n stuff is in there. You're right. Oh, sorry, you were counting that. You're counting the sorting.
Right. It's essentially, the while loop runs it at a stack only in pop can be done. There's already in there. That is what it's called.
It's called an aggregate analysis amortized analysis. So, who's seen amortized analysis? This is sort of a basic technique in analysis of algorithms. We're going to do a very special case, which is easier than most other amortization. It's often just called an aggregate analysis. But before we do it, at least one person should tell me why this set of nested loops only takes linear time. What's the key idea?
You can only pop it once.
Yeah, nothing gets popped more than once. Right, once a point goes on the stack, it's off, it never goes back out. So we only touch a point a constant number of times. We're just going to count the stack operations. each point gets pushed once. Each point gets pushed once. It gets popped at most once. I guess we did some other stack operations because technically we peek into the stack. We peek into the top two elements of the stack, but each time we peek into the stack, we either push or pop a point. If it comes out negative one, we pop. If it comes out positive one, we come down here and we push. So we'll call that two peaks per push or pop. And so the total here is so any normal stack implementation that can do constant time pushes, pops, and peaks will give you a linear time algorithm, assuming you've had them sorted by angle. Okay. Any questions on this analysis? Let me go into a little bit more detail on what happens, how this sorting really happens. Because if you were writing, for instance, sort by angle method in C++, and you wanted to use a C++ quicksort, and you had to write a comparator for two points, and you want to do it using our line side test or our orientation test, well, the orientation test technically takes 3 points. And sort by angle, actually, even just saying that should make you a little nervous. Because if we're going to sort, say, by angle around something, what's the first one? Well, when you have angles, usually you have to make some arbitrary choice and say, ah, this is zero, and we're going to take the minimum. But like things like, you know, negative pi is equal to 3 pi. The point is that it's not a total ordering on the circle. It's, when you're looking at a space of angles, so you can go all the way around. So we have to be a little careful that we picked leftmost point that we call P0, and our compare function, so to compare PI and PJ for our sorting, what we're going to do is we're just going to take the orientation of P0, PI. And it should be what that the comparator, what's the usual primary comparator returns, what? Plus one if it's less than or equal to? Is it the other way around? So should minus one if PI is less than or equal to PJ? Let's see if we got the order right. Let's say this is PI. PJ. The orientation of this, in this case, PI to J, this is plus one. So that would be what? That means that PI is greater than equal to PJ. And that would be our max. That's what we want. So this gives us a comparison of 2 points in terms of our triangle orientation test once we fix some reference point, the point from which we're measuring everything else. And we do have to be careful that it really is a leftmost point, because if you pick some point in the middle, you would get, well, like if I had points going all the way around, I would have I is less than j, this point is less than this one, this one's less than this one, this one's less than this one, this one's less than this one, and then I would have a comparator which is inconsistent, right? It wouldn't actually be a proper ordering. So it's important that we did this, we at least spend the linear time at first to find the leftmost point. And we could have picked leftmost, bottom, top, rightmost, any extreme point to be sure that we have one to start with. All right. Why is the algorithm correct? There's a couple things we need to check. We need to check that, well, all the points on the stack, or all the points on a convex hull. We have two things. First, all the points on the stack are on the convex hull, and all the points on the convex hull are on the stack at the end. And those are the two things. So let's do first, let's say all vertices of the convex hull are on the stack at termination. Okay, when I did the line side test, we did the example of testing if two lines intersect. There's another problem I forgot to give you, which you should have seen. I think you would be able to work it out, which is how to check if one point is inside a triangle defined by the other three. So if I have P0, say, and I say PI, PJ, PK, there's three points. If they're sorted I to J to K in this order, and I pop PJ, then just by looking at what the orientations of these points, it needed to be the case that what? This triangle, 0IJ, was counterclockwise. This one, 0JK, was counterclockwise. But we popped PJ, and the condition we looked for to pop PJ was that we had a PK and we had a right turn here. So this was oriented this way. If you have these triangles all oriented this way, this point must be inside the triangle formed by the other ones. And if it's inside, if it's strictly inside this triangle, it's not on the convex hull. Okay. So when we popped it, every time we pop a point, we know, in fact, locally, we have a witness that guarantees it's not on the convex hull. So key point here is we only pop PJ if we're sure it's not on the convex hull. Technically we check that this orientation of PI, PJ, K equals -1. And so again, just by the sorting, the guarantee we got from our original sort, we know that the orientation of P0, PI, PJ is equal to the orientation of P0, PI, PK, which then again is the orientation of P0, PJ, PK. And that all implies that J really has to be in this triangle. Not in the convex hull. Okay, so all the vertices that are on the stack, or all the vertices of the convex hull really are on the stack, because the only ones we popped were the ones that were not in the convex hull. The other thing we need to check. Is that the orientation of any three consecutive points is always a left turn. So we know this pi plus 1, pi plus 2 is equal to 1 for all I in the output. I guess I did something tricky here is I renumbered the points based on their order in the output. So if I look at three consecutive points in the output, I look at the orientation, I made a left turn. This is what you might call the all left turns condition. You can get yourself in trouble with this condition. It's a purely local condition to check for convexity. Well, in this case, the algorithm makes sure this is true. This is the invariant of the algorithm. It's enforced by this loop. If it was ever the case that we had a right turn, we'd pop the stack. And we keep popping it as long as there's a right turn until we have a left turn on the top of the stack. So this is an explicit invariant of the algorithm. We know it's true, We need to make sure, though, that it also means that we have, we actually get the output comments home. At this point, you probably believe this algorithm works, to say this must be right. Let me try to confuse you. Let me give you some doubt. I'm going to draw you a polygon that makes all left turns and is not convex. Who thinks I could do it? Okay, I'll even make it so that all the points I touch are on the convex hull. Gonna do it, I promise. Everyone ready? All right, I'm gonna make a left turn. All right. Make a left turn. Take a left turn. Left turn. Left turn. There we go. All left turns. It's not convex.
They're not sorted by angle.
Yeah, so somehow this condition needs to be combined with the fact that it's also sorted by angle in order to guarantee that we actually output a convex thing, right? Because imagine that you ran this algorithm and you had some bad implementation of your comparator, and someone gave you just the points in some other order. You might think, you know, because this kind of analysis is still true, this invariant is still holds, you might think that maybe the algorithm works even if you don't sort the points. But because of this example, this kind of example, which is called a winding, or it's what we would call a non-simple polygon, where the polygon intersects itself. Because this can exist, we have to be a little more careful. All right, just enough time to go through this proof. Is everyone all right if this goes away? So we want to check that if we have sorted, if we're sorted by angle from some leftmost point, and we have all left turns, then we are, in fact, a convex polygon. I hate to throw this one out. Here's our lemma. P0. And I'm going to write it like this. So I'll call it the first point P0, but I'll also call it Pn. And that'll just save me some time when I write my indices. So this is P0, P1, all the way up to Pn-1. There really are only n points. And we have this condition that, so given these points, such that, one, the orientation of every three consecutive ones, pi minus 1, pi, pi plus 1 is equal to 1, draw I equal 1 to 4 minus 1. And two, we have that the orientation of p0, pi, pj equals 1 for all I less than j. So the first condition is in all left turns. And this is sorted by angle. Okay, that's our hypothesis for the lemma. If we have this, then the claim is P0 all the way up to Pn minus 1 are the vertices of a convex polygon in counterclockwise order.
What is the second condition?
Oops, I missed one. It was 1. So it's saying that if I go from 0 to I to j, for I less than j, I'm going to get 1. This is the comparator. These are the vertices of a convex polygon in counterclockwise order. So it's going to suffice to prove that each edge, pi, pi plus 1, has a supporting line. Um, that. So this like defines the support line. So here's the idea, sort of a sketch. We're going to use induction. And you show that removing a point other than pi, pi plus 1, or, let's see, pj. Yeah, so we're going to show that if you just remove one point, the same conditions will still be satisfied. And then we're going to show we add that point back in, and it in fact gives us a convex polygon with that one more. So, all right, so for a particular pi, pi plus 1, let's draw zero. So if I have this set of points, and I'm looking at I want to know about removing this point C. If you take away a particular point, the sorting is still satisfying. So we still have condition two. We just need to check that you will in fact still have all left turns. How do we check that? Well, we know that zero is less than the angle. I'm going to run into a notation here. Let's say angle sign is big here. The angle from A to B to P zero is less than so A. A, B, P0 is less than the angle from A, B to D. Which is less than the angle, so A, B, D is less than the angle from A, B, C, because this had to be a left turn. Which had to be less than pi. So the angle here, the orientation of B, D, to E, which is going to be the new turn that we get when we remove C. We're going to remove C and we'll see, look at this one. This angle has to be also a left-hand turn. I'm sorry, well, I guess what we just proved was this angle, ABD, is less than pi. So we saw that's this one right here. And by symmetry, this one will also be the same symmetric argument will tell us that this is also a left-hand turn. So when we remove C, we still have all the conditions are satisfied. We have one fewer point, and we'll be done by induction. The base case is like, you just look at 3 points. This is clearly true if you just have 3 points. Right? Because it's only a single triangle, and it says that they're oriented the right way. So now if you want to show that this is true in general, where you get a convex polygon, you just show that when you remove this point, you get these same conditions are satisfied. Now you have a new polygon, which is simple, convex polygon listed in counterclockwise order, and you just add one point. That's sort of the sketch of the argument there. We're running out of time here. Let me just give a quick summary. So we did convex hulls of planar points. And we saw what? It's as hard as sorting. We also saw that's not harder than sorting, as we have at least one algorithm which, just by employing sorting, can then solve in linear time. It's not harder in the asymptotic sense. We saw the gram scan algorithm. And the key things you should take from gram scan, right, is that sorting by with linear predicates, that's pretty cool, right? It says that you can turn this line size test into a binary comparator. And the aggregate analysis. Questions?
Are you going to post the notes?
Yeah, the notes, I'll post the notes. And also, I'm going to post some other notes and to HuskyCT, because I scanned some stuff from a book, but I don't want to post that on public internet. So you should get an email from me through the HuskyCT system. Hopefully that works. If you're not enrolled, you may not get one. You can email me directly.